we'll use the metaphorical gavel here and call ourselves to order. It's the annual meeting of the State Debt Policy Advisory Commission on the 16th of January. We're here at the Capitol. Thank everyone for being present. Those of us, I think everyone has done this before, so we don't need to go through the explanation of the order, but we're going to hear from our staff and draft of the report. The commission is certainly well positioned to comment on that draft, and typically we start with Laura Lockwood McCall and kind of update on what's gone into the draft that we have before us. So, any comments from the commission to start?
Johnson,
please.
This is the draft. We're going to discuss it today, and then what's the timeline if driving back to where will we come from, we ponder the mysteries and come up with something else?
Senator Johnson, my suggestion, and we've used this before, would be for you to give us feedback and comments today, as well as we'll give you a day or two.
A day or two would be perfect.
And then the goal would be that we wouldn't necessarily have to meet in person, that we could send out redline version like we've done,
perfect,
and set up a conference call. Our goal, of course, is to meet the legislative deadlines, and so Capital Construction will probably start having hearings. Yeah, so we want to get the report in everybody's cubbyhole in advance of that so that we're well-positioned. If the committee wanted us to do a presentation, we could do that as well. So I think by meeting in mid-January, the goal was to give us a week or a week and a half to scramble to get a final version of
that. That's all I needed. Thank you.
Great. Very good.
Sir, would you assume, do you want to introduce the crowd before
that's
we...
That's a good suggestion. We'll go around the room and offer some introductions if you would. Sir.
Good morning. I'm Paul Odenthal from Oregon State University. I'm Senior Associate Vice President for Administration.
That's Paul.
Mike Green, Oregon State University, Vice President of Finance and Administration.
Dean Gabriel, Capital Finance Team, Christine Wilson, the Management Division of Treasury.
Great. Thank you.
Here's Public State Treasury.
Ryan Mann from Treasurer's Office.
So, I want to introduce you to my last person behind the scenes, helping us crunch the numbers and prepare. Lee and I are retired June 30th. Laura Worth comes over from ODOT. She was a senior quantitative analyst, and she'll be our SDTAC analyst in the future.
You just passed over that kind of quickly. You're retiring?
No.
He retired on June 30th.
Lee and I have retired.
He retired.
Thank you. I thought you said I am. You about gave me a heart attack.
Have you been listening on my private call?
Okay, cool.
No, but, and so all kidding aside, Laura has worked in debt. She had worked at ODAP, but more in a quantitative role. So in the last 3 months, she's issued bonds for the first time in her life and helped develop this report and has been drinking out of the fire hose, to say the least. But she will be our day-to-day point person.
Great. All right, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Did she miss anything? Anything to add?
I don't think so.
Okay.
She's a beaver, among other things.
Right.
So that's good. And so
popular in this room, yeah.
Although there will be some ducks here soon.
I think last New Year's Day we were all ducks. Breaking.
Yes, we were all ducks. So.
Love this.
There you go. Anyway, I'm Laura Lockwood McCall, and head of our debt management division.
Great.
Nancy Nathanson, State Legislature.
Tim Dewey, Public Member, University of Oregon.
Tobias Reed, State Treasurer.
Betsy Johnson, Legislative Member, Senate District 16.
Katie Koba, Director of DAF and Chief Operating Officer of the State.
All right.
That
names.
So with that,
yeah.
As Tim said before you all got here, he just has read these reports enough to only read what's new. And I've purposely kept the report's structure very similar over the years to make that easier because it's so dense with information. And teaching Laura about it reminded me just of how dense it really is. You turned it on?
Okay.
And I'll start. So I'm going to go over sort of the same set of slides as we have in previous years, but kind of highlight anything that I think is new unless you want me to go back to how we do stuff just in terms of brevity. This, again, is the introduction that tells you why we're doing this. Laura, in the process, she sent you a little email in terms of we were updating a section about other state debt capacity, and there had been a Pew Trust report about 50 states' debt capacity, and I had forgotten that had happened, and so she was all excited to tell you that we're leading the way We're one of the nine states that does the best job among 27 states that do debt capacity reports. And so hopefully, as we keep tweaking this and improving it, we'll continue to lead. But again, we've been doing it for a fairly long time, and I think we're starting to talk about capital planning, but in a very broad way. Mm-hmm. And highlighting debt policy issues is something that I think has been a more recent. I have a few to share with you today.
So doing this must improve your relationship with the rating agencies, too. I mean,
it's important. It's always a credit positive that we have a good report. It doesn't hurt that Pew Charitable Trust thought we were among the best in the state.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not move the needle, unfortunately, to get to the AAA. So you need to change the initiative system and a few other things together. So again, these are the categories of debt. The report goes into depth about what they are. This is our 10-year projection of where we've been, where we're headed. And as you can see, debt's being paid off, new debt's being added. So throughout this past decade, the categories of debt have somewhat changed. We have probably less appropriation debt and more GO debt, but the reality is that our overall debt levels have stayed relatively constant, which is, I think, the goal of is just to continue to invest but not get in over our head in debt. And again, that was going on from the depths of the recession through much better times. So this is just the general obligation debt, and that portion has been going up. The big news that will be a big focus of this year's report is that we're now in a 10-year window where the pension obligation bonds that were sold in 2003 will actually start going away by 27. We've been amortizing them, but it's been an upward sloping amortization. So the amount of principal we'll be paying between now and 2027 will become more dramatic over time. Come on in. And so I think that's important because we're in a 10-year window, and now that 10-year window is post paying off the pension bonds. We've been refunding COPs with GO debt, and so that's partly why appropriation debt's gone down. There's still some that will stick around. But we've been using these lower-cost, higher-rated Q bonds since the constitutional amendment was passed a decade ago. And we saved over $100 million in interest costs. So with one act of the legislature, and then whenever we had a strategic opportunity, we just keep refunding. So I only ask for 1% for both, but that doesn't seem to happen. But it's a great thing because we've just gotten more and more efficient as we go, I think, over the decade. We have about $1.8 billion now of Q bonds. It's our largest GO bond program at this point. And we also have a lot of GO bonds, both Gs and Qs and Fs that are associated with university debt. And because that was a big focus of the last decade as well, is to deal with capital needs in the university system. The revenue bond program has stayed kind of constant. The lottery bonds are at the bottom. They're the orange. Well, we have a lottery capacity model that does the same thing. We pay off lottery bonds. We issue new lottery bonds. And even though there's been a lot of modification in terms of revenue over the last decade, as we did video terminal replacement or smoking bans or this or that, we kept true to ourselves, and we just sold lottery bonds at the same pace to basically keep indebtedness roughly equal. Housing has shrunk a bit in terms of its overall program. The single-family revenue bond program shrunk because of the economy and post-recession starting to pick back up again, and we're going to see those numbers popping back up. And, of course, the big thing has been ODOT debt. But, again, ODOT's got the same kind of internal capacity where there's a certain finite amount of revenue, old debt comes off, new debt comes on the books, and when necessary, the legislature has provided additional revenue. But quite frankly, ODOT debt has remained relatively constant, too.
Relatively constant and in an okay place from your perspective?
Well, there are AAA at the senior lien and AA plus at the junior lien for S&P. So, yes, I'd say that it's been a very well-managed program. The legislature has provided good resources, and it's been well-managed, and we've put a lot of energy collectively into getting some of the best interest rates of any state transportation agency in the country. Now, management of projects, I'm not speaking to. Well, what I'm speaking to is how well it's managed.
And it results in the coverage ratios and so on as well, yes?
Well, we have some coverage ratios, but we've actually exceeded them. And the
so, I mean, not exceeding them as well.
Yeah, and we have really strong fund balances because we basically have collected revenue, and then we do projects, and then we take it out. And so we have deep liquidity as well. And so in general, it's just we put a lot of energy into making a well-oiled machine from a bond perspective.
So just to recap, given that transportation has sort of been everybody's dashboard,
sure,
if you'll excuse that expression, I'm wondering about the big projects, the pressure for additional projects, the cost escalation in some of the projects, and I'm not asking you to comment on how well ODOT estimates costs or any of the rest of that, but I'm wondering about additional capacity for ODOT to issue debt in other issue areas. Specifically, there's been a lot of pressure about Connect Oregon, again, given that the money was completely subscribed for projects in 2017 where the projects were named in the bill. Could you comment a little bit on where, if at all, you see any opportunities?
Well, I would be happy to. The limitation in the strength of the ODOT credit is that the Constitution says you can only use those highway user tax for
highway
user tax. So the Connect Oregon program is about everything
you
else.
You answered my own question. That was a stupid thing for me to ask you.
Of changing the Constitution and broadening the definition of transportation, instead of calling it highways, if you said transportation system, if you had the guts, then all of a sudden we could do a lot of other things with those same resources and dollars. And, yes, we probably could do a lot more with the capacity, but it's the same thing with the carbon credits. We couldn't use them for certain things and other things because they have the moniker of highways rather than if we call things transportation systems, we may be able to escape that.
Thank you for the very gentle reminder that I asked you to bring down.
Well, I sit around and talk about it with my staff all the time. Too bad we couldn't. So easy for me to say. I'm not the voter, the person to vote for that.
You would be if the Constitution would change.
I would be happy to vote for that. okay. So when we get to debt capacity, we look at our general fund, we do a separate forecast, we do our lottery back, and then we give you some statistics about how we compare to other states, and then we have some non-tax-supported loan programs and to talk about. So let's start with general fund. This is the range of projects that use general fund resource. One thing I'll note is that this is updated every year by the folks in capital finance at DAS, that the Qs and the COPs are much more general fund supported than in previous years. It just is the nature of the projects, what gets paid off, what doesn't. But in general, the big gorilla is pension obligation bonds, and that's been in the 33% to 35% of overall. I'm so sorry, my phone. Let me get rid of that. Apologize. So that is the big chunk, and that's why you're going to see in a moment why we have so much debt capacity freeing up, because as those bonds get paid off, the general fund, the ratios, all things being equal, drops somewhat dramatically towards the latter part of the forecast period. But as of when we took the snapshot, June 30th, we have $4 billion in general fund debt. In the model, we assume whatever the legislature approved and the governor signed as part of the bond bill for 1921. And of that was $946 million. We assume the methodology in terms of timing based on information from LFO and DAS. Most of that debt will be sold in the second year of the biennium. And so you can kind of see the categories of debt and things we'll be selling, although we are going to have a sale this spring for some of the capital seismic upgrade grants and a few of the Q projects. But a lot of the work will be in the second year. We also were told that there was an allocation sitting on the sidelines of unused capacity based on our last year's forecast, $325 million. What's that? Okay, for some reason we might not have that exactly, maybe we'll fix that, but I thought it was 325 based on previous. So we assume that is going to get issued and we include that in the model. We're assuming that the legislature is going to be out allocating some additional debt in the February session. We use the same long-term forecast approach, so we have the latest revenue forecast. We assume a higher interest rate than it has been in a while, but I've just given up trying to find a different rate because who knows, but I'll tell you, we're borrowing it 3% and under, and sometimes on a taxable basis. So I think they're using conservative assumptions. And we keep that same motto of we're not going to spend more than 5% of our general fund on debt service. So I wanted to show you, before we show you the results, because they're much higher than they've been in the past. The chart shows you the darker blue is the principal payoff. The lighter blue is the interest component of that. And then the green shows you when we sell the new bonds what that's going to be. The red shows you what our capacity could be in terms of debt service based on the revenue forecast. So, again, we're kind of at 4.5%, not at 5. But just, you know, we're being conservative and we aren't using all our capacity right away. But the forecast for the long term is pretty positive. And you see in the last 2 years this drop in 28 and 29 because we've just reduced the amount of principal associated with
it. And that, I think, is you also foreshadowing some of the things we're going to talk about today about opportunities that might line up in terms of timing, right?
Exactly. We've invited into the university folks from HEC, Dennis joined us, to talk about their most recent report about the long-term strategic needs of the university system. And if you remember last year, we had Alice come and talk about the deferred maintenance needs. So I think that might be a hint and a theme that at least the treasurer's office is sharing about this grand opportunity with a lot more debt capacity and how we might best use it as a state. This is the numbers that result from the forecast. And you'll see that all things being equal, with all the assumptions we've made, we have over $6.3 billion in capacity. That's a good billion and a half higher than the last one that I was there. And as I said, it's primarily because of this extension of our forecast period now out to 2029. So we have the base case, we show the balance, and then we just give you sensitivity analyses if we go higher or lower in terms of revenue forecasts. That's the big news, almost $1.5 billion. Mm-hmm. For the last decade, we've been at anywhere between $900 million to $1.1 billion. So that's the news. I'm not assuming we're going to do it this year. We're sort of looking at just what's left for this balance. But I do think it opens up opportunities and conversations about $400 million per biennium of additional capacity. We could also decide that we want to have a lower threshold. Maybe we don't want to be at 5. We could say we want to go lower, or we could say we could go higher. The point is that using the same methodology, we've now eliminated pension obligation bonds as the use of our scarce resource, and we can put it back towards bricks and mortar if we so choose.
This might be a time... Try and
no, I was just going to say, you took right the opening I was going to offer. If people had reactions to questions, so go for it, please.
This might be a good time, having listened to you, Ms. Lockwood-McCall, talking about additional capacity, and Ms. Bible can correct me if I start straying from the truth here. The tri-chairs are taking a very conservative approach, desirous of maintaining shock absorbers against where we are now and the possible vicissitudes of the business cycle, or God forbid some geopolitical thing that has a profound global economic impact. And so we stayed pretty true to where we had wanted to be in the 19 session. We have staked out some pretty aggressive territory in maintaining these balances that are good shock absorbers. That goes throughout the budget, bonding capacity as well as other expenditures. And I can tell you that the pressure is unbelievable. Senator Steiner Hayward, who is the other co-chair on the Senate side, and I pinky swore that we were going to do all of the meetings for requests for money together, and we have been very true to that agreement. Last Thursday, we met and had from 10 o'clock in the morning until 5 o'clock at night a steady parade of people coming in asking for money. We totaled it up, not with any precision, but it was someplace between a half and a quarter of $1 billion in requests. All kinds of projects, bonding requests, cash requests, and I just at least want to put a marker in the ground for the purpose of the deliberations of this group that it is our stated principle, and we'll be coming out with principles shortly for the short session. It is going to be one of our principles to not gobble up all of the capacity for the reasons that I have previously stated, and I would just turn to Ms. Bible, who has been nodding her head in the affirmative, which has given me confidence, but I did not stray from the path of truth here anywhere. Okay.
And to your point, Senator, that's why we do this report every year, because this is a 10-year forecast. We're not saying use all $6 billion. We're constantly refining it.
In fact, we're saying don't use all $6 billion.
Exactly. We're averaging it, but we are giving the heads up that if we so choose from a long-term capital planning, there may be some additional resource available for folks. But it's, during the recession, we stopped selling bonds because the numbers changed so dramatically, the FOID sensitivity, that suddenly our ratios were too high and we just had to delay projects. And we need to be prepared to do that as well.
Well, I'm going to ask the treasurer and economists in the room to comment on something I'm about to raise. I certainly understand that when revenue isn't coming in, we need to be careful about what we've obligated ourselves to be paying back. On the other hand, I remember very well, I live in Eugene, and the University of Oregon, it always has more than one construction and renovation project going on. It's an economic engine for the whole area. There were some people who still had jobs during the recession because there were those major projects that had already been approved. When there was a major recession, the federal government had the ERA, Reinvestment Act. There are reasons why you want to keep people working to the extent you can. Borrowing isn't necessarily the best way to do it, but what if it's the only way to do it? So I would like to hear just a little bit of discussion, since in the Revenue Committee, when we hear the economists tell us, well, maybe something is on the horizon, things are slowing down, what should we be expecting? Because there were times when I realized I really appreciated that some people who otherwise would have been not working were working because we had approved projects that kept going on when everything else was starting to draw back in.
Before they answer, I just want to tell you the number of times I drove over Cornelius Pass during the recession into Hillsborough and saw that covey of cranes over the top of the Intel site, and thank God that Intel stuck with Ronald Reagan. So I see your point.
I heard some amazing statistic at that point that the Intel project represented some crazy number, like 3% or something of the entire construction in the United States or something. It was a huge impact. So it's true. I'm loath to be in front of a PhD economist, but I think you make a good point in conserving some of that capacity for the time that it's needed. But I don't think any of that is inconsistent with the message that McLaughlin Call is delivering, which is here are the numbers, here is the way to think about it over the long run, and it's up to you and the legislature to think about the right ways to deploy that to the maximum benefit of the state. I think our role is to focus on those numbers and say these are the impacts to the ratings and the rates that we're going to be able to get on your behalf.
I would sort of add, there's a lot to unpack what you asked. We could spend a lot of time, and I'm happy to do that. Maybe
not
outside of this. But in the near term, we're projecting with 4.5 was at our low as far as our debt capacity.
Our ratios are about 4.5.
The lowest was 4.5. So the nice thing here is that there actually is a little bit of room in the near term that you could in fact keep some of those spending projects alive even if revenue dips. You'd have to push off something at the other side of it. But there's actually some wiggle room in the near term on this, the way you've got it set up.
I think that, of course, there's legislation, but one of the great things about capital renewal and deferred maintenance as a funding is that you can make it go up and make it go down. And, I have to say it, but keeping roofers employed and doing a lot of roofs and plumbing and things aren't glorious and ribbon cutting event opportunities for people, but are the thing about, and so the report, Treasurer asked me to emphasize deferred maintenance, and the folks from HAC are going to be talking about the needs of deferred maintenance. So that is maybe an in-between solution, which is we don't take on huge, gigantic responsibilities if we really worry that revenues will drop. But there's a lot to be said for hitting a lot of singles and keeping the construction industry going during tough times. And truthfully, we did. A lot of ODOT projects were approved. At the height of the recession, we were one of the few states that raised gas taxes. And I just saw a U.S. News and World Report about best states to live in, and we didn't. We came in the middle. But guess what? We were number one in the United States infrastructure. Washington State was number two, because both of us did a lot of that work even during the recession. So I think it's all about modulation and flexibility in terms of being able to expand and contract businesses.
Yeah, well, and I think there's another interesting question that I would get from that, Nancy, is that it's possible to allow us to go to 6% during a recession.
That's why I said you can make it bigger or smaller.
That limit. And that'd be an interesting question, should we hit the next recession, and to what extent do you want to try to use the debt capacity cushion it, which traditionally we've avoided, but there's not good theoretical reason to say you should avoid it. The other nice thing about the next recession is we actually have a statewide cushion that's much bigger than
reserves are much bigger
than in the past. So I'm a little bit more comfortable over this cycle given our positioning than we've been in past cycles. I also don't think the next recession will look like the last one. The last one was fairly severe. And so I think there's a lot of interesting questions, and maybe we can talk about it.
Perhaps at the University of Oregon where there's a construction project.
We can find a construction project in the city. So what am I happy to do that?
I agree with everything that's been said. The only additional information I want to add is we have been trying to do construction projects within state government. Construction costs right now are so high because of the strong economy, and that's one of the benefits that you get when the economy dips a little bit is your prices go down, which is also helpful.
Yep.
So we definitely have needs now. I'm not discounting those, but being in a position when you move into a recession to be able to use one of the tools that you have to stimulate the economy and take advantage of better prices.
Right.
And usually interest rates are usually low, too.
That's right.
Which is helpful, too, although they've been extremely low.
Which also is good to keep at 4-5% or low. It then does give us that flexibility should we need it to take advantage of those kinds of opportunities.
So our entire approach, I feel like, has been judicious.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do have a pretty good credit rating, all things being equal, except for that darn initiative program. So. If I could move on.
Yeah, any other reactions or comments on geobonds, or we can move on to our... Go ahead.
So $1.2 billion outstanding as of the year. Lots of different programs, uses. The bond bill had $302.5 million in new lottery bonds with a little cushion left over that's theoretically unused that could be allocated at the session if so desired. Same revenue forecast. And same kind of assumptions. There is a 4x coverage or 25% cap in our indenture, and we've kept that here. I've been showing this to you for a while. The long-term revenue forecast continues to improve. So blue was 2 years ago at this time, green was last year, and this is the red. Now, the sports betting, the net of proceeds of which comes to the state, has now been included in the long-term forecast. It represents 2.5% of the overall projected revenue capacity. So a lot of this is more population-driven than sports betting. But and Amanda asked me to crunch the numbers just so you know that it represents about $11 million of bond capacity. So it's a decision if you want to not bond for it, that's fine. But it's not really driving why the numbers have gone up.
Ms. Lockwood-McCall, are you associating any kind of risk with the sports betting? And would that be reflected in this document? Let me be precise. I think a number of us were surprised that lottery would choose to bank at the Bank of George in Nevada. And do you assume any risk about computer performance or any of that sort
we
of stuff?
We rely completely on Office of Economic Analysis baking that into their revenue forecast. So we just literally take their number and we use it in this report. So that's the a better question. Do we ask the revenue committees when the next forecast comes out? And
I
know
you consider that question posed.
Okay. So for better or for worse, they're assuming a very small net amount comes to the state. I don't know if that answers your question or you're worried about it cannibalizing other lottery monies.
Yes.
Okay. And I just don't know the answer to that. Mr. McMullen gets to answer that question. So the forecast stuff, as I said, I think it's primarily driven by population growth. The fact that the La Center Casino hasn't really cannibalized revenues as much as initially projected. So when you take that 1.7 and you do the same thing we do with averaging, well, we've been in the $300 million range. We're now looking at future bienniums of being over $400 million. If you net off the sports betting lottery, we're still over $400. It's just a little lower in the 400s that's available. And then the capacity and sensitivity is just based on OEA's forecast if it goes up or down.
Before we go on, let's ask the same question. Any general reactions or comments on lottery distinct from general obligation?
This is another dumb question. At this point, are we aware of any other initiatives looking to carve dedicated funds out of lottery? The number of initiatives that are coming in so fast that the last time I looked, there were like 52 or 57 of them. And I didn't know if that had changed and there were any other...
I haven't read or been asked to look at anything. And I would need to let rating agencies know, so I don't think so.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's definitive, but it's not on some informed people's radar.
But I'm going to go after this meeting and go look on the Secretary of State website again.
Good enough for today's purposes, but it's a constant, I think, threat. And I'm just going to lament for the record the fact that I think if people knew that by passing some of these dedications, they're functionally making big policy choices about other opportunity.
Yeah.
If I were Queen, I would certainly have more description about source of funds for some of these, but that is not the case right now.
Yeah.
That's
a message that doesn't seem to get across the voters, that they're taking money away from something else.
Yeah.
Having said that, though, we do have a fiscal impact committee for each ballot measure, and we should be sharing that information about debt capacity to that committee when they do their analysis.
I would welcome that. I mean, if you put a ballot measure for an initiative for world peace, it'll pass, but at what cost to what other programs and what other capital opportunities and yada, 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 yada.
Well, when I was looking at this, very specifically a couple of years ago, I was really impressed by people not understanding that when this was established, I forget, a few decades ago, the exact year, 100% was for economic development. We're down to less than a quarter now is used for that purpose, for original purpose. So the phrase eating your student corn comes to mind.
And the definitions have become so elastic that that exacerbates the problem.
It's a vice and a virtue at the same time. Because it solves problems in a crisis.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the reason we do net tax supported is the rating agencies, every state's got different constitutions, financing scheme. So they like to see any kind of debt that has a tax related to it all in one bucket. And so our fine-tuning of the general fund portion versus their need to compare 50 states is what net tax supported means. So we throw in all the pension bonds because it is full faith and credit of the state, even though the general fund only pays a third of it. All of our COPs and Q bonds, our lottery bonds, because they consider those tax, even though it's not really tax, and our highway user tax bonds. So when you add all that up together, it's $8.7 billion. And that's, so we forecast out based, again, on authorizations for ODOT debt, lottery debt, et cetera, paying off debt, bringing new debt on, this is where we'll be. We'll be at 9.37, we project, billion by the end of the biennium. There is a fairly significant chunk of ODOT that's tied to HB 2017 that we think will issue that for 480. Yeah, so that is one of the bigger components. But we are paying off some of the debt, too. So, but it will be a higher number than it was at the beginning of the plan.
To what degree does the Treasurer's Office do any independent analysis prior to the issuance of debt, or are you simply issuing debt based on what the legislature authorizes and the governor signs?
Well, our job is to issue the debt that but we do have a sort of a fiduciary duty to look over the shoulder of everybody, which is why emerging issues, I would say, enrollment growth, are you really sure that these self-supporting higher ed bonds will be self-supporting? And I have done that before, and I have intervened in one case, and I had state senators tell me to get my nose out of it, the legislature approved it, to sell those bonds. So we do our very best to try and document and to get good fiscal analysis and projections, but we are implementers, not deciders.
This brings up one other important point, which I asked to include in the report, and we'll have a chance to react to it. The legislature obviously can also dictate the timing of specific issuances, and there is a danger I understand the attraction of putting it later in the biennium, but if it's all concentrated, that has an impact on the market dynamics as well. So that's another
we've added that. But generally, I mean, we're trying to give you good advice ahead of time.
Yeah.
And I've tried to work with Amanda on better analytics ahead of time so that we don't have to be the bad cop at the end, rather that you've asked the right questions in the beginning.
Well, it's that old issue of crossing the Rubicon. What I think we're finding, and again, I would look to Ms. Feigl, correct me if I screw this up, but folks not having plans that foot, they get an initial appropriation for some bonding capacity, and then surprise, surprise, a $2 million project is now a $12 million project.
Yep.
And when have we, to use my analogy, crossed the Rubicon, that you've spent this much money on pre-design and engineering and the rest of that, and then find out that the numbers were grotesquely underestimated, and how politically do you back that back out? And I think that the Legislative Fiscal Office, especially with Ms. Beidle's leadership, has put a much more rigorous process in place. It isn't just who's got the legislator with the biggest stick who can beat a project out of Ways and Means. There has got to be more cost estimating discipline and more, I believe, transparency and truthiness in talking about a project that is advertised to the legislature as a $2 million bucker and it's really a $12 million bucker.
I absolutely concur.
Also, the prospect that we will fund something and then find out that it becomes the black hole of operating problems. And so we buy the first piece of it and then, oops, the public commission that was supposed to be handling this has failed, and we're now stuck with an endless hole to throw money into.
So for what it's worth, I did debt capacity studies early in my career back east. Maryland always has a master capital plan, and you have to put the budget costs, the components, and the operating costs. And it's a discipline that's done a lot in local governments as well. We just we haven't come up with which office, which agency, but I think that as we mature as a state, it behooves us to do a master capital plan. Higher ed starting to get that. And if it's LFO, so be it. But they're going to need a lot more resource and people to be able to do what Maryland's been doing for, I hate to say how long I've been, was doing in the 1990s.
If you'll indulge one last comment,
so,
Mr. Chair, and I say this respectfully because I understand that there are higher ed advocates in the room. I have begged you guys, there are only seven of you, some people want to count eight. There are only seven in my worldview. That you take it outside and you get agreement among yourselves and you stop asking the legislature to see who you love most. And producing a list that I acknowledge, it was an expensive list, but that list seems to reward the biggies and not so much the little guys, but some kind of a coherent plan that projects capital out multi-biennia. I think everybody can stand hearing no for an answer if they believe they're going to get a turn in the barrel sometime. But if the system is rigged in such a way that the biggies always get their projects and the little guys never move up the list, I don't know how that serves Oregonians necessarily. And I just wish that there are only seven of you. Take it outside and figure it out. Don't make us pick. Somebody's going to be disappointed. And that's the end of it.
And you haven't even heard about the report yet.
You may go and see. Oh, I've heard about the report.
Yeah, well, the others will. This is Moody's view, just to keep rolling with our piece before telling. So from Moody's perspective, they look at public debt, and they hadn't historically looked at balance sheet debt, which includes unfunded liabilities for pensions and for other post-employment benefits. So the green bar is the Moody's medians, is long-standing. And then the layers of our cake are different components of net tax-supported debt. We would be at the median if it weren't for the fact that our ODOT bonds and pension bonds existed. And we could argue till we're blue in the face, it's constitutionally dedicated, why are you including it? We could say lottery is not a ruling tax. We're never going to win. So it is what it is. Our debt ratios have been coming down because, and I use on purpose the personal income, because our personal income is going up per capita. So as you saw, our debt ratios have stayed relatively constant. So I guess we're getting closer to the medians, but we're still going to be above them for the foreseeable future. We're a growing state with growing needs. As you know, I've been proponent of the S&P approach, which is with a whole balance sheet approach that took into account everything. This is from this most recent report from S&P. It just shows you state funding levels. And it's a little hard to see. It's leaves in your book, but Oregon is in that best category, which is the lightest colored.
I should have known that I was in the worst, so we were kind of getting.
Yeah. But
you're going to jump out, Andrew, doesn't it?
But as I mentioned, I worked back east for several years in Virginia, and Virginia was a triple-triple-A in Maryland. But, you know, look at Virginia. They have this triple-A, but their funding ratio is way below ours.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess I kind of take personal kind of
umbrage.
Exactly. Well, no, when I was there, I was a big proponent of being a triple-A. I'm loyal to whatever state I work for. But I think that it just shows you that there's a lot more to overall liability management.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rating agencies are getting more and more wise about it. I will say Moody's is getting better at it, too. So this is the 50-state S&P chart. And what they do is they take your debt per capita, your net pension liability per capita, your net other liabilities, which is our OPEB liabilities per capita. They add it all together. And then they say, okay, so where do you stand? And then black thing is showing you the state gross state product, which is close to, not exactly the same as personal income, but an overall sense of what's your revenue streams, you know, in terms of ability to pay. We were a little further to the left last year at this time, which I'm not quite sure why we're higher, whether they did the math wrong, because I don't think we've changed all that much, other than that we're a mark-to-market system. So when we have a higher net pension liability, we mark to market. But this is coming from GASB, CAFR related. So I think that shouldn't matter. So I can't tell you exactly why we went to the middle, but we're still down in the lower ranks, which I guess I'll hang on to that this
mm-hmm.
year. And we're not in the crisis mode that places like Connecticut and New Jersey and Illinois are in.
Yeah. That's how I would interpret it. I didn't know. I couldn't.
Yeah, I had to move that green arrow from the little bit further left over to the middle. So
but there's a clear discontinuity there between all of the states and, you know, that last 10, group of 10.
Exactly.
The major goal is to avoid being in that discontinuity.
Yeah.
No kidding. Well, they were folks who used pension bonds in some cases to pay their annual pension costs, not just their unfunded liability.
Right.
And that one-time move to balance their budget had 25-year implications.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it goes. So there we are. Anything else on net tax supported?
Comments, questions? Okay.
So these are the programs that really are self-supporting, the idea being that they're loan programs. They pay for themselves, that we hope the general fund never has to come out of pocket. Unfortunately, the general fund had to come out of pocket to help the Department of Energy with some of their loan programs from some loans that we've run out of loan reserves. So a few million dollars is now helping cover some of their debt, but they still have loans for a portion. We're in the process of refunding some of their existing debt, and I'm hoping to that will help with the bottom line, that the general fund won't need to step in again. Pollution Control has a general fund program and a loan program, and the orphan program is just general fund, and the loan program for water, wastewater is the balance. So really those programs are all doing pretty well.
Or to what degree do you monitor these, or what's the cycle of scrutiny when you say they're doing pretty well?
Well, we sell their bonds. So we, in the case of Oregon Housing, we're working with them to sell all of their bond issues. They get decent credit ratings from Moody's on their first-time home buyer. So we're this issuer, so we're looking over their shoulders. Everybody's paying their debt service on time, reporting information. There's just I don't have any financial scary stories to tell you about. If that does that, I mean,
yes, that answers my question. Let me nuance it a little farther, and this maybe isn't in your wheelhouse, but there is conversation about an issuance of another round of housing in the LIFT program, and I'm trying to correlate the investment by the legislature in necessary programs and what do the deliverables look like on the ground. And there's a case in point where the legislature put $2 million at risk in a low-income housing program, that the product came in not low-income. They, the board, had an executive director who went to another state and borrowed using the housing as collateral, was unauthorized by the board to do that. These guys have now gone radio silent. They bank was going to foreclose on them. So I guess, is it housing's job to look to see downstream this massive amount of money that hits the ground? How well is it spent? Is it delivering on its intended purposes? Does low income really mean low income?
Well, they have they signed pieces of paper at closing that says that they're going to do compliance oversight to make sure. When we sell bonds that are tax exempt, there's federal laws about the median income of the house. So, there's due diligence up front, and while we're assisting with each of those transactions, because we're kicking in geo lift money, we're selling bonds, and then they're getting tax credits. I don't know the specific situation, but we sit on every conference call. We make sure everything is coming together, but we don't have the resource of Treasury to do independent due diligence from Oregon Housing.
And let me separate this because this is on an on-the-record conversation. This was not one of the big projects with a sophisticated developer who does this all the time. This was a much littler organization with enthusiastic requesters and a laudable mission that got lost somewhere to the finish line.
Do you
want to...
Go ahead.
There is a more frequent comment now from the Revenue Committee over tax expenditures, and in a way I kind of see bonds and debt in the same way. The issue for me when we start talking about this is spending on housing. What is it we're getting for that expenditure? How many families are going to be helped in this given year? How many units did you build? How many families now have affordable housing instead of living on the street or in danger of living out of a car, for example? What are we spending on that? And it's not investment in a public asset sometimes. It's a direct subsidy for a private venture, right?
Or a nonprofit.
Or a nonprofit. What would it have been like to spend the money instead more directly on a service? Why are we investing this way and going in debt and borrowing instead of using that same amount of money in a direct program expenditure? That's a more and more frequent conversation now coming out of the Revenue Committee.
I think it's the right question, but I do think it's Oregon Housing, the Oregon Housing Council, you know, in terms of the full range of services. We're about to talk about Private Activity Committee. They have provided me a great deal of detail for another committee we're having next week where we ask units of housing, types of units, what's it costing per unit to build, how many families are affected, how many minority families, low-income families. And it was a compare and contrast to some other requests that we've got at PAB, which I'm about to talk about, that don't affect nearly as many families. So I feel like housing has those answers, and maybe it's just a question of sending you all a copy of this report, but having them come and talk about it, because I do think we need a master plan, a strategic master plan for the highest and best uses to get the most bang for the buck.
That's it.
Would it be appropriate for them to come to the next one of these meetings, given the magnitude of the investment in the housing space? And you guys will make that decision. But I agree, Representative Nathanson, with what you're saying completely. I toured a project that's being paid for with Lyft. It is rehabbing a hotel in Astoria that was built around the turn of the century. I don't know on which side of 1900. Trying to preserve some of
the project
architectural features of the building. It's lath and plaster construction. We were down in the basement where there's standing water. And it will be beautiful when it's done, but it asks the question, would it have been more valuable to find a greenfield site and build a new building that was completely up to code and wasn't relying on the kind of ancient architecture and rehab necessary to save this old building?
Great question.
And I don't know the answer to that. Common sense tells me when I'm standing in the basement 2 feet of water that maybe there was a better spot. The city fathers will debate that because they get this old hotel and an eyesore and a blight in downtown.
I think capital construction should more than, we're really the capacity group. My advice would be capital construction should hear from Corrigan Housing about how they're using Lyft dollars. It's already built into the bond bill, and so they could give a status report on the grants they've done, and they have details on each project. I don't know who decides which projects, but that's the Lyft grant project. They manage that grant award program as well. So my suggestion and advice would be to get an overview of how the grant program's been going and the successes and the failures to date. Okay, so we've been talking about private activities. We're right in the heart of it. The one thing about Lyft that you should know is that theoretically it's a small chunk of equity because most of our multifamily housing is mostly revenue bonds tied to self-supporting revenue bonds tied to 4% tax credits, and then Lyft is supposed to just be the yeast to fill in the gap. So I don't know if the Astoria project has more yeast than the average project or not.
I don't know the financials. I just walked through the building.
But the difficulty is that our program has been working well because it has been able to finance a lot of programs on the coast and in rural parts of Oregon and underserved communities where the tax credits and the PAB allocation alone just weren't enough to make the numbers pencil out at all. And so what's happened is it's such a good idea that now the local governments are selling geo bonds to do gap funding. And our crisis that's coming at us in the housing space is that everybody's going to want private activity bond allocation so they can marry their geo bonds, the metro folks in the different communities up there, with PAB revenue bonds, multifamily revenue bonds, and then tax credits. And we still have economic development projects that are floating around that want PAB because, again, under federal tax law, it's the tax exemption benefit. You get a lower interest cost than you'd otherwise get. You could sell taxable bonds tomorrow. But if somebody says, I can borrow at 4.5% or 5% instead of 7% or 8%, it's a very nice thing to have. The problem is that multifamily housing, to get the equity tax credits, and that's a really big, important deal, it's the only game in town because federal law says you must use tax-exempt bonds to match with your equity credit. So this is the only game in town to do this multifamily. The choice, of course, is you could do 100% as Representative Nathanson, you could do 100% just state geo bonds. But if you can keep it being a little fraction, like 5 to 7% of a deal rather than 100% of the deal, again, it's bang for your buck. So this past year we had $440 million. It's all based on population. So each state gets allocated a certain amount under federal law. We get it $105 a person. So we have $440 million. We used 191 right away. 150 was for a much larger Intel project. It was a $600 million wastewater recycling project they did on the campus. We funded a portion of it with tax exempt. They financed the balance of the taxable bonds or other resources available to the company. And we did do some affordable housing through housing. If you don't use it in a given year, it becomes this thing called carry forward. And the federal law says you basically have in January the PAB committee, myself representing the treasurer, Jean representing Ms. Kova, and a public member appointed by the governor who happens to be a gentleman by the name of Dan Anderson, get to sit in a room and we get to decide where how we want to allocate that carry forward. And it's a one-time decision and they have 3 years to use the money. And it's not really money, it's just you can sell your bonds on a tax-exempt basis. So over the years, housing's gotten most of it. It's not all of the carry-forwards, although we have done other things with it. And they have picked up the pace of construction across the state, and they used $253 million of carry-forwards this past year. And they use a small portion of their carry-forward to do some first-time home buyer programs. We have about $248 million available in a meeting that we're going to have next week. That's what I was telling you about the memo. And we have $208 million across. One of our requests is to give some additional allocation to a waste-to-energy project in Southern Oregon. We've already given $245 million in allocation to, and they have some additional costs that they want us to cover. We have a request for
Liberty to say the name of that program?
It's called the Red Rock Biofuels Facility in Lakeview, Oregon.
Okay, well, may I?
Yes, please.
One of the things that I would like to try to capture, and I'm saying this to LFO as well as you guys, is where all these asks are coming from, because there are pockets of asks for Red Rock everywhere. We've already invested heavily in it. There's now going to be a bonding request for a rail spur. They're coming and asking for more here. What's the risk profile of that project if for some reason
talked about our non-tax-supported conduit revenue programs. We've already sold those $245 million through Business Oregon, but it's non-recourse, and the risk to us is zero because it says all over.
It's not a state obligation,
just like the housing projects and Oregon Facilities Authority. You know, we can assist them. We have to just decide whether we're going to give them tax exemption version of their additional financing needs. It's a complicated project. I know a lot about it.
The question for this committee and this discussion we've had in preparation for that is of this finite capacity available for the committee, is it best directed at that, which we know about, or is it best directed towards housing or some of the other things? That's the discussion, which is informed by what the risks are inherent in that project and what led up to it, but it's worth reiterating what Laura said. It's not a state risk in terms of having to make up that cost. It's just allocation you couldn't send somewhere else.
I appreciate the clarification. I guess I'm looking at it in a larger picture.
Yeah, absolutely. Your questions are...
How much state investment in one project? Now, it also begs the question of, we've crossed the Rubicon on that one, in my opinion, and it's a little akin to the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. Building half a bypass is like being sort of pregnant. If we've gone this far with Red Rock, do you not push it over the finish line? Is this the finish line? I don't know, and I won't be party to the
decision. I don't know, but I think we have to keep reminding ourselves, it's just what is the cost of their money? It's not that...
Yes,
we can't help them get their money. As I mentioned, Intel got some. The question is do they get to borrow at 7% or 8.5%? It's not whether we can help them borrow money.
Thank you.
There's risks with additional bondholder consent. There's risks with their outtake contracts expiring prior to when they think they're going to be completed. So there's more risks than I can tell you about, and there's very little equity, and it's a lot of debt and a lot of federal grants.
All your questions are right. I was just trying to say
that again. I love
but
they're very good questions, and I would be happy to have you come to our meeting. But we'll learn more. Some of it is going to be confidential. I will say that the request for the PAB has gone through the Finance Committee of OBDD. That request comes in through a state agency on their behalf. And OBDD is willing to put some of their current year allocation into the project as well. You should know that the legislature had heard about this push already, so you collectively in the bond bill bumped up Oregon Housing's allocation for 2020 to $250 million. It had been about $125 million per year.
This is that total, that's the $105 dollars per person. So yeah. $250 of that total is now statutorily obligated to housing.
And so the committee has less than it used to have. And so we'll be faced with lots of questions as to highest and best use. Again, I point out that the local governments, we don't know whether Metro and City of Portland, for all their different gap funding, plan to go through Oregon Housing or whether they want to come to our committee or both. Oregon Housing's done some projections that assumes that even if we gave them all the carry forward and all the currents and 100% of everything, they still wouldn't have enough resource to meet their planned throughput. But I do think your question about are they using the money wisely, are we making sure that every single dollar is for the right project on clean sites versus rehab sites, I think those, are really important questions, and this is probably the right time to ask it because there's going to be a food fight over the use of PAB. And we need to ask it of our Metro fellows, so we should probably be asking it of ourselves. And we should hold ourselves to the same standard that we're going to probably need to hold all the different communities in the Metro area because we simply don't have enough. And the deeper problem is we all want to do more housing. The federal government has just restricted our use of 4% tax credits and PAB in a way that doesn't meet the real true needs of all of the communities on the West Coast. California's got 10 times as much capacity, and they're having the same battle. As is Washington, as is New York, as is Florida. There are many parts of the country that they call flyover. They turn the capacity back to the Treasury, and they don't need it.
So Ms. Mann is part of our liaison to the National Association of State Treasurers is getting into where we might, as an association, try to advocate for some changes in the federal level.
And but I do think we need to clean up our own house the way you suggested first so that we make sure that we truly have a crisis. I think we have a crisis. I think it's going to get worse because we won't be able to meet our needs. In the housing memo that I received that I'll send to you, they plan to sell more bonds taxably, too, and they'll have to use more GO proceeds to do the same project. We all need to just sharpen our pencils together. They're going to have to scale back their single-family program, first-time homebuyer. They're going to look at new approaches. They're going to look at securitization off-balance sheet completely away from the state to continue to do down payment assistance. So there's a lot going on at housing that's worth the legislature knowing about. Okay, that's all I have to say on that. This is really the conclusion. Additional capacity we've talked about. POBs have paid off. And we have great growth, which is great. But at the same token, I think we're mindful that the economy could change. The legislature's got tremendous numbers of competing demands. And that we just want to hope that we'll continue to use it for the highest and best process and resource. And we like deferred maintenance, as Jim Gass said. The second half of this, and the reason we asked Ben to come at this point, was to talk about the higher ed capital strategic plan and some of the findings of that report.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
As Ms. Lockwood McCall concludes, I hope I speak on behalf of the whole committee to thank her for her professionalism, her competence. We are incredibly lucky that she is in Oregon, and watching her go through this report is a pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Thank
well,
you.
Thank you for saying that.
Before we make that transition, let's just make sure that the draft is, in my view, broadly reflective of the presentation you just gave. But just to make sure I have this right, Ms. Lockwood McCall, are we going to come back to that before we leave, or do we want to just conclude that piece that people should review that, get us your feedback, and we'll come back to talk about the specifics of the timing on that maybe.
But sure. I wanted to make one
quick. Yeah.
We added
please.
A section last year about the forestry lawsuit. It's still in there.
I wasn't going to let the meeting conclude.
I saw that.
I needed a little bit of the knowledge, but I did still say, because it's maybe an appeal, that we need to be mindful of it. We're not going to – but if we do lose and we have some – we will incorporate in the capacity study.
Right.
So we didn't talk about that. I apologize. But I think it would be great because all these higher ed people are here to talk about that next issue.
So this is the executive summary. This is the exact report.
Mm-hmm.
May we get copies of this?
Yes.
You have a – copy of that was delivered to you.
Sorry, it's in the tsunami of stuff that has accumulated.
Just before you leave, today is the 16th. Why don't we say that you can get us comments by mid next week?
Laura could send another electronic copy to put it at the top of the inbox.
Our goal would be to take your comments, and then the last week of the month we'll have a conference call to go edit comments.
By the 22nd, end of day on Wednesday, the
22nd.
That would be my recommendation, and then we'll schedule a meeting for the last week of January to review any edits or comments.
Okay.
Cool. That would be okay.
We'll wrap that up again just to make sure everyone's clear at the end. But in the meantime, we're happy to have Ben Cannon here to talk about the study. You all just completed.
Thank you. Treasurer Reed, numbers, glad to be here. So I'm here to talk, as Laura mentioned, and Treasurer, you introduced, about a significant piece of work that we undertook in 2019 and that the HEC is using to help inform its recommendations to the legislature on investments in higher education capital. I'd say this was an unprecedented piece of work. This was an attempt to develop a 10-year plan for investments in higher education capital in order for us to advise the legislature more strategically. And I think we embarked on this because of some perceptions, partly founded, maybe partly unfounded, but definitely rooted in some truths, some perceptions that our decisions about investing in higher education capital have been made largely on a political basis, perhaps that universities have an insatiable or unjustified appetite for capital investment, that the state has had little or no plan for making those investments and not a very rational basis for deciding where and how much to invest in higher education capital, that we are merely reactive to what gets, you know, presented to us instead of having a proactive approach. And again, I think there's a certain grain of truth to some or all of those perceptions, but this report was an attempt to discern sort of where the reality is and how to become more strategic and effective going forward. So I have just a few slides. This will be pretty brief, and they are the result of a much more, you know, a pretty comprehensive piece of work. I have a link to it. I didn't bring hard copies, but I have a link to it in the final slide, and I'm happy to supply the full report to members of this committee or others upon request. But you know, part of the reason for the importance of this conversation is the significance of capital investment as part of the state portfolio, as Ms. Lockwood McCall's slides and presentation identify. It has become a very significant portion of the state's capital portfolio, and this is the about 12 years. It includes the 2019 authorizations, but you see that $905 million of total investment over this time period in the 11G lottery and 11Q programs, an additional $302 million on the 11G and lottery for community colleges. So the first line is just the public universities. The second line is the community college program. And finally, the 11F, the non-tax supported but state bonds that are invested by the universities, funded by the universities. So this is a significant question for the state. So we worked with contractors, and I'll tell you more about our consulting team in a moment, but to develop a 10-year plan for state capital investment. That's this report. And the goals and process are described here, really to provide a high-level summary of the state's capital needs for public universities based on demographic, economic, industry, and other factors. It was undertaken over much of 2019, really launched in February, but an intensive project. I've done in partnership with our stakeholders, including campus visits. I'll describe those in a little more detail in a moment. An extensive analysis of data. The consulting team, a national organization called Smith Group and NCHEMS, it led to 4 main recommendations and 7 findings, and I'll describe the recommendations in some detail in a couple of slides. The consultants themselves, the Smith Group's national firm, they have expertise in facilities planning, architecture. They've done this sort of master planning work for states and state systems, both including higher education. They partnered with a nonprofit, National Center for Higher Education Management in Colorado, as well as an economic consulting firm, MZ, to support in some of the predictive modeling that the report employs. You see some, there are some of their qualifications and expertise. The data that, that you know really underlies this report is extensive. It much of it is generated by the institutions themselves, and we worked closely with institutional staff to make sure we understood their existing capital infrastructure to the extent they understood it, their plans for that space, their utilization of that space, their own projections and expectations going forward. You see some of those data categories there. And then we, our consultants used our Population Research Center at Portland State University, economic and workforce data coming from the Employment Department, MZ, other entities to develop the projections going forward related to higher education demand and its connection with workforce needs. The study process involved significant outreach and engagement with stakeholders, so the consulting team made two trips around the state to all seven universities plus the OSU Cascades campus, met with leadership, staff, community members, stakeholders to deeply understand the unique regional and institutional context of those universities. And these are the categories of recommendations. So they fall into four buckets, and some of them are quite detailed at the kind of subhead level. I won't get into most of that, but again, I'm happy to explore it in discussion and certainly to point you towards the full report. The top line, and you know, I think the one that, at least for the commission to this point, has generated the most attention, understandably, is the recommendation that the state invest primarily in capital improvement and renewal at universities. And there are a couple of key...
Ben, when you say renewal, what's that code for? Is that deferred maintenance? Is that garden roofs on buildings? What is that?
Yeah, so it's a broad term that can mean and include certainly deferred maintenance, taking care of what we have. It can also mean improving what we have in order to meet the new needs of learners today, of teachers today, of researchers today. So modernization. Absolutely. So it's not just the failed roof, right, which would be a classic deferred maintenance kind of example. It would also include the upgrading of buildings to meet modern needs.
Distinct from new construction.
But distinct from new construction, and that's really, that's the, I think that's the point of the first sort of bullet point here. As our consultants looked statewide at our existing infrastructure, our existing utilization, and our expectations for enrollment and the deployment of programs in higher education, they did not identify that there will be capacity issues at our universities writ large. In other words, our existing footprint statewide at our public universities is approximately what it needs to be, probably, in order to meet demands from students over the next 10 years and demands of our workforce. So this led them to the conclusion that the state capital plan should not require significant investment in new infrastructure, new expanded infrastructure. So that that was a key takeaway.
And how does this, and I should know this, I've seen this presentation now four times. Okay. But how does this take into account the acquisition of what I'm going to call new urban facilities? Downtown Portland, does this count, did your consultants look at rental space in different locales? Were those satellite facilities calculated in their diagnosis of our situation.
Senator Johnson, yes. So the data upon which this is based takes into account all of the university's existing capital space and how that's being deployed and used today, as well as theirs and ultimately our projections for future enrollment demands, and then it performs a sort of, you know, gap analysis and does so both at a university level as well as at a statewide level.
Enrollment demands versus marketing capacity. I mean, I see a distinction there. I'll pick OSU. You build a facility in Portland, build it, and they will come. I don't know. Am I parsing that too tightly?
So these become complex, and I think you're right to sort of explore the complexity of these questions. When we approached this, when our consultants approached this from a using a model of enrollment demand based on factors such as high school graduation projections, population growth, age bands within within Oregon's population projections, and an understanding of the higher education marketplace sort of nationally, that led them to certain sort of conclusions or assumptions about the future enrollment demand within Oregon. It is certainly the case that there are universities, and OSU is likely one of them, that will describe intentions and expectations and projects and approaches to generate new market demand in particular ways that they sometimes will claim won't come at the expense of other Oregon universities, but will be actually bringing new students into the system that our consultants may not have anticipated, right? With they so that result, that I think that's one of the reasons for the discrepancies that the report finds between the university's own projections for enrollment growth, which tend to be quite optimistic and aggressive, and our consultants' projections, which were in contrast, quite conservative, or quite a bit lower, even when they applied what they believed were pretty aggressive assumptions around increased demand and increased population. So even when they tested it, they still found pretty significant gap statewide between the university's projections and our own. I am talking about this in very broad brush. So I'm talking about statewide. There are locations, regions, and the consultants note this in the report, where there is not likely sufficient space capacity. They identify Central Oregon, for example, where as one area where we will likely require additional footprint within our four-year infrastructure in order to meet enrollment, likely enrollment needs of that region. At the same time, since I mentioned Central Oregon, I'm really talking about Bend, they also point out that the Oregon State University's own expectations and projections for enrollment demand are greater than what our in Bend are greater than what our consultants identified the need to be. So yes, there's a need. No, it is not, in their view, as great as OSU has said.
And jump in there, Representative, some nice questions.
If generally we have about the right footprint, but we need some more capacity in one place, as painful as it is to ask about this, we certainly get these questions in city planning and land use debates all the time about no net gain, no net loss with urban growth boundaries. You hear all these fights. Does that mean we have really a little more capacity somewhere than we need? Or to better afford our investment and what we should maintain and make sure we're keeping up to date and modern, should we say, well, this thing here really, as painful as it is, maybe we just shouldn't be supporting it?
I think that's a reasonable way to characterize the findings here, that on a, well, again, I've talked on a statewide basis, we're at about the right size. that means in some places we need a little more, in some places we probably need a little less. And that's detailed in the university and in the bulk of this document is institution by institution analyses of existing space, projected enrollment, gaps, either direction, right? Too much, too little, and how that plays out.
Are you asking if there's too little somewhere, why don't we just move those students to somewhere where there's too much?
That would be a question I'd ask.
Oh my gosh, school boards have had to grapple with that.
I think that's your question, the bigger question. And then I think if you ask that question, then you have to ask, what is the broader purpose of society's role for some of the smaller campuses or campuses that we do not think are the biggest? And then that gets you into another set of interesting questions. And I would hate to say again, I'm happy to talk to you.
I'm not sure that I'd be happy to hear about that.
But there are interesting questions there that then I would think also get to Betsy's comment that the biggies are on the top of the list. And I think that maybe if you did in process like this, that an honest process, maybe that's what falls out. And then what do we say after that?
I don't disagree with that, and it's been a question for a long time as some of the TRUEs, as they're euphemistically referred to, went from colleges to universities and have struggled financially. What is the obligation to Oregonians throughout the geographic breadth of our state to have access to a physical locus for higher education versus which of the littler schools close their eyes and they picture Eugene as what their campus ought to look like? What are the realistic expectations? And I think in that interregnum between the assassination of the Education Coordinating Commission and the birth of the HEC, there was a lot of kind of runaway expectations. And those runaway expectations have perhaps led us to a place where, given the change of character of education writ large, we've got ourselves with more physical plant than students, and I don't know the answer to it. Certainly thinking politically, the last thing you want to do is to call up Southern and say, should you continue to exist?
What? No, I agree with that. I think you're asking the right questions then is to, right, how do we manage the system that we sort of let develop over the, say, last 5 or 10 years, and maybe get back some of the control that was lost in that intervening time.
I'd be for that. I mean, we were the ones, the legislature, that gave away the boards and all the rest of that stuff, and I put a kind of mixed bag of results, in my opinion.
I won't comment on that.
Thank you.
I'm happy to talk about capital, though.
Let's keep going, Ben.
Thank you. So I have emphasized the takeaways in the first column here on this slide about recommendation number one, but I want to place equal emphasis on the findings and recommendations of the consultant relative to the need for investment in capital. So, again, do we need a lot of new space? No, statewide. Do we need a lot of investment? Yes, and that is investment in maintaining and upgrading and overhauling what we've got. And so the consultants use this sort of best practice figure of investing 2.5% a year of your current replacement value. So that's a $10 billion total current replacement value for really education-oriented space. We're not talking about housing and food and athletics, but $10 billion, 2.5% of that a year would be $250 million a year need for investment in improvement and replacement of existing facilities.
And this is the connection, remember, to what we talked about earlier on when the retirement of the pension obligation bond occurs, when there's some additional capacity that comes available from the state.
And it ties to last year, Alan's presentation,
right,
about you can pay a little bit now for deferred maintenance, you pay a lot more later. And so, again, so that's the way I tied the little bow together. is that you have this opportunity to talk about if these are the highest and best uses of heat capacity that the state's going to see coming at us in the future.
Whether it be statewide or university system.
Yeah.
What about the deferred means is a less is important, but often not sexy. It's not a big new thing
right.
that people like to invest in.
Right.
So
it's a wide thing. It's
a wide thing. Taking care of what you have, but I think that's why we're highlighting these issues.
Right. Well said.
I'll just note that the majority of the buildings at our universities, state buildings, are over 50 years old. In some cases, they were not. The prior state policy made it difficult to maintain them adequately. There are some very significant needs for maintenance.
Ben, I would just challenge the last statement that you made respectfully. Budgets are about priorities. Somebody decided not to worry about the roof.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that my reference there was to prior policy from, as I understand it, the State Board of Higher Education and the Governing Board of the universities that meant that they could not spend tuition dollars on these kinds of deferred maintenance activities. So there was a limitation on the way that universities were permitted during those decades to maintain their buildings.
I take your point.
The next recommendations, I mean, may seem to depart from capital to some extent, but they were very important to the consultants and have significant relationship to capital needs going forward. Recommendation number two, this bucket is about collaboration really between our institutions and in the service of what the consultants identified as growing workforce and program needs around healthcare and STEM exist. Growing opportunities around the delivery of online education and the value of incentivizing collaboration between institutions to better use existing space, more efficiently use existing space, oftentimes or sometimes in combination with online delivery, so through hybrid models. But this has capital implications. I think it's one of the ways that they attempt to address or believe that the state can attempt to address areas of new and growing needs without significantly growing the capital footprint. So there's quite a bit in that. The recommendation number three relates to institutional roles and missions. This came as I did not expect this, hadn't anticipated that we would get recommendations along these lines from this project. But as it turns out, as the consultants really dug in, they concluded that one of the reasons this job of developing a 10-year this project was complicated and difficult for them was because of a lack of what they believe is a lack of clarity around institutional missions and institutional differentiation. So, for example, whether or not Western Oregon University develops a significant healthcare professions portfolio as part of its academic programming has significant implications for its capital needs going forward. Whether or not, or the fact that Oregon State University Cascades today is part of a R1 research university with highly intensive research activities expected to be undertaken there by its faculty has significant capital implications as a result of its OSU's research-oriented mission.
And what's an R1?
It's the highest tier. It's a category of universities nationally that have high research intensity activities, so really your large research institutions, which Oregon State University is one. So the consultants recommended that we would become more effective at capital deployment and capital planning as a state if we more rigorously define institutional missions, not just the mission statement, the sort of one or two sentence statement that the HEC is responsible for approving today, but a more rigorous definition that goes deeper into the audiences that are to be served, programs to be offered, and any unique roles that the institution has. The final category of recommendations includes some somewhat technical suggestions for us and for the universities, but important in the view of the consultants around improving the process and practices. Some of this is about data collection. They were surprised, I think, to find at some universities, and this is really the smaller universities typically, the capital inventories are not what they should be. The data that the institutions have is not of the quality that it ought to be in order to aid effective planning. They recommend more systematic approaches to data collection, adding professional staff, and doing a better job of maintaining condition assessments. So there's a whole set, 10 or 12 specific recommendations under this category. So we got this report in October, the Commission got this report in October, and we were under the gun to produce a new capital list for the 2020 legislature's consideration. So we've taken portions of this into account, the Commission has, in the development of its recommendations for 2020. The way that we make those recommendations currently is by grading each project that's submitted by a university against a rubric that our staff uses to apply points, to assign points to the project based on how well it meets the requirements of the rubric. The Commission very quickly adjusted the rubric, overhauled it to reflect much of what or some of what I've already told you. So it added points or created, weighted the assignment of points more significantly on the degree to which it a project addresses, aligns with this plan, including an emphasis on renewal, dealing with deferred maintenance issues, collaboration. So it made other adjustments to try to bring the rubric more closely into alignment with the plan. I would note, and this it goes back to something Senator Johnson said early on about this process, the way that we do this is not designed to promote equity or turn-taking among the institutions. It is designed to grade each project individually and largely irrespective of the institution from which it originates based on these criteria and fundamentally in alignment with the plan. So theoretically, one university could have submitted five projects and found that they were the five highest scoring projects on the list. There's really no, and there's a slight asterisk on this, but essentially no consideration of the perhaps the political desire and maybe the appropriate desire to disperse projects around the state, nor is there any consideration, again, potentially appropriate, but nor is there any consideration for turn-taking, the fact that a project may have been submitted last year or maybe 2 years before that, and 2 years before that has no bearing on its grade, the grade that it receives from us. This was our timeline. We've completed this process of very quickly receiving this report, adopting a new rubric, grading the projects that were submitted to us, and in turn submitting that new prioritized list to the governor and to the legislature. Although wasn't necessarily asked for this, I figured we would, you know, questions would arise. I did include the project list that we submitted last month to the governor and the legislature, the ranked project list with their scores, and you can see this will be what's in front of the legislature next month. The final thing I'll say is what you don't see on this list are is the funding that the legislature authorized in 2019. You know that the legislature held back on approving most of the funding requests for public university capital. It did, however, approve the $65 million capital improvement and renewal fund that we administer via a formula that is designed to support smaller dollar deferred maintenance projects, typically at universities. One of the Commission's products coming out of this capital study, apart from this new ranked list, is a view that we should consider increasing the proportion of the total state funds that are dedicated to universities, university capital, increasing the proportion that is in that CIR fund, those small dollars, not project-specific, not these large-dollar projects, but allocated via a HEC formula.
Two quick questions on that formula. You said primarily at universities, that suggests there's community colleges too?
I misspoke. That fund is entirely
okay.
For universities.
And are there matching requirements or anything in that
formula? Those are 11Q and not matched requirements.
Okay.
Ben, has any consideration been given to, I look at OSU's project that has a $35 million, I believe it is a single donor.
25.
Okay. But $35 million is a huge piece of that project.
You're talking about the number one?
No, I'm talking about number. I can't see the damn number.
The number six. Yeah, sorry.
Arts and education.
Yeah, the arts building.
Thank you.
So that has a $35 million private sector participation, which is a very significant. The question that I want to ask is, in order to stretch what dollars we have further, for the bigger institutions, U of O and OSU, what role can their foundations play in stepping up with a greater level of participation that might cause the list to be more elastic?
And before you answer, let me also just let you know that when Mr. Cannon's finished, we're going to ask Dana Richardson the screen to come up too, so you can feel free to answer as you want. And
okay, why don't you just hang on to that and I'll put it to
well.
You guys.
Yeah. Great. Other, did you cover everything you want to, just feel free to answer if you want to.
I will just note, I mean, the projects do gain points in our process through gifts. So that is one of the ways, or institutional matches. So that is one of the ways that projects can move up this list is by leveraging institutional or private sector.
Sorry, you had your hand up before. I forgot that.
That's okay. My other question is, so I see a 2020 list. I'm kind of curious about the 2021 list, 2022
yes.
list. Yes. I'm interested in the totality of the deferred maintenance that we're talking about and how those get prioritized. So the universities choose which projects they want to bring to you for this year.
So I would say that we're in a I characterize it as a transition period. We just got this report in October. This report is an attempt for us to take a more proactive planning look. We are still applying a largely reactive model where universities that did not have the benefit of this report when they decided what to submit, at least for the most part they didn't, are submitting things. Most of these were submitted actually for 2019 funding. They may have changed in the intervening months, but probably not a lot. So we're still in this process of kind of doing the old thing of getting their submissions and grading them. Going forward, I think this report gives us an opportunity to be more set higher expectations and develop more of a plan, including potentially a multi-biennium plan for the state investment in university capital going forward. Somehow that has to mesh up with the institutional needs and the institutional prioritization process. And I think we've got a lot of work to do still to figure out how to make those two things sort of roughly come into alignment.
Did the universities know about your rubric before they submitted this last time?
They do, although I would just point out that, yes, the process is for the commission to establish the rubric, the universities then to determine what to submit and how to submit it, and then for us to grade. In this case, because we got the report was completed in October, the rubric was quickly adopted. A couple of weeks later, their project submissions were due. They had very little opportunity to take into account the new rubric before they resubmitted. I will say we were working closely with them and the consultant throughout the summer. They knew generally what was going to be said. There shouldn't have been any huge surprises, but I want to give them the ability to speak to that.
My experience with these things is that once you have something that's there, a rubric, then the rubric becomes something that you deem.
No.
No, never.
I've heard of that.
I'm just starting. What's your flexibility here? What's your, I mean, so if I say, if you put this in front of me, I say, well, I'm going to I'll leave it at that. That you can, this, once you've got to, so this might work this year and match up what you think the outcomes are with the school submissions. I'm just saying what's going to happen next year when they actually know what the rubric is. Are they going to modify their? Are they going to modify their plans? Are you creating the incentives that you want for them to modify their plans going forward?
I may have a slightly different take on your question, or maybe it's the same. But to me, the nagging doubt has been, or the question's been, do they modify the projects, and including what they submit, or they, do they modify the report, the proposal that they, what they put on the page?
Sort of in all that space.
Right, and I think, you know, it's probably involves some of both, but our hope would be the former, right, that the adoption of the plan, the receipt of the plan, the adoption of the rubric sends a very strong message to universities and their boards about what the state expects, what will score well. I will take this opportunity to make the point that, and Senator Johnson has certainly heard me say this before, that our ability to have that impact going forward is only as strong as the legislature's willingness to fund this list and not be selective about choosing, picking and choosing. Because if
to adhere to it, to make
to adhere to it.
And not
to
part of it.
They have to trust your list.
Yeah.
And then they have to, I mean, there's a lot of trust involved.
Exactly. And, but it's why we did this report. Right. It's why we did this report.
Right. So. I understand that.
Exactly. Okay. Questions for Ms. Cannon? Thank you for coming and explaining this. It's very helpful. I did not have the benefit of seeing it before, so it was good. Good for me to hear it.
And there is a link to the full plan.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks.
So for a reaction to that, it's important for us to hear from Ms. Richardson.
We don't have slides, so
that's
we'll
fine.
Maybe
no problem.
Take a little space down
yeah,
here.
Yeah, please. That's great.
You can sit way over there, Mike. I can't kick you over there.
we can throw them.
There you go.
Hi, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Presidents, which is a voluntary association of Oregon Public University Presidents. So really pleased to be here today to just provide comment on this report. The HEC put a lot of time into this, coming out to campuses. Our folks put a lot of time into this. It was a big lift. But we think the product really emphasizes a lot of the things that we have been emphasizing for years. So you may know that about 50% of the state's capital assets are on university campuses. Almost half of those are 30 years old or 30 years, minimum 30 and up. That's important, as you may know, because right around 30 to 40 years is where all your systems start to fail, your mechanical, your electrical. So it becomes a really critical point, and we've got a lot of assets that are nearing that kind of tipping point of use. Which is why we love what we heard in the report, right? Focus on aging infrastructure and subsystems, renovation of existing spaces to repurpose them for current students, focus on resiliency, ADA accommodations, as well as certain need for new space to support student success. So just to drill down a little bit more on what Director Cannon provided you with regard to the focus on the improvement and renewal of existing capital assets, the 2.5% is an industry standard for renewal. As he mentioned, that's about $250 million a year. They also included an industry standard maintenance amount, which is 1.5%. So that's about $150 million a year for that just ongoing maintenance. So if you roll that up to a biennial number, you're like at $800 million, right? Like, it's not been something that the state has supported at those levels, but that is what we've seen in the report. As you know, and this isn't unique to university capital projects, but when we do get these investments, we create jobs. Over the last 10 years, the dollars that we've gotten for the state, we've created almost 14,000 jobs. But again, that's not unique to us. We do include apprentices on our jobs, and of course, they impact rural and urban settings. So that's a little bit of stuff that's generally applicable around capital. And Mike's going to talk about some ways that investments in university capital are unique.
Thank you, Dana. Again, Mike Green, Vice President of Finance Administration, Oregon City University. I'm here representing all the universities today, so my comments will be pretty general. But, you know, how is it unique? How is investing in university capital unique? Well, one of the things we talked about a little bit was we provide matching funds. Over the last 10 years, we've provided $456 million in matching funds to support the capital projects of the university. And for this particular list, there's another $91.4 million on this list for 2020. So that's significant. It's unique to higher ed and leverages the state dollars well. There are critical student success gains associated with investments in modernization of our buildings. Changing student demographics really show that redevelopment of the infrastructure into a modern infrastructure will be supportive of student needs today. One of the report itself mentioned that the loss of women and minorities in STEM fields is a risk here if we don't have buildings that accommodate the interactive learning experiences.
I don't understand that. The building doesn't know what the students are, gender or ethnicity, or I don't understand your statement.
So, could I follow up?
Sure.
The report talks about the type of space that's helpful for them, and they want a place where they can collaborate and work together, and space can induce that or preclude it.
But that's applicable to every student cohort.
Well, at least the report identifies that for those students of color and women, it's particular to them to feel like they are getting the feedback that they need in their educational experience to be successful. So you appear dubious, but...
Who am I to fight with million-dollar consultants? Sorry.
Having taught for a long time, I can attest that the many of the spaces are outdated and don't provide the kind of collaborative learning experiences that apply, I would say, to all students, but the lack of those spaces can, it prevents maybe the kind of communications that reach out to students that are traditionally not within the service hall scope.
It's the difference of standing in front and lecturing to people versus getting them into groups, and that's an example.
So I don't think this is complete nonsense.
I take your point.
Okay, so this is a realistic concern, having worked in a lot of buildings, that I can't make a connection to students because there's an object in front of my way that's preventing that. And I think for some students that are not maybe first-time college students or from traditional college-oriented families, having those additional physical barriers is a challenge for them.
And I think, you know, along those lines, the type of learning that's needed today that really meets the workforce demand by more interactive learning is really not supported by facilities that were 50 years old.
I'm not going to disagree with that either. Someone doesn't like me and I get assigned questions that are 50 years old. Because I know there's newer ones on campuses, but I on campus.
Send
him
down to the
basement.
He's experiencing it.
But yeah, there's some odd buildings with, say, fixed, narrow desks, and they're not conducive to a diverse population.
I can't even fit in. That may be more about me.
Yes. Not conducive to learning.
Just really quickly, what would investment in renewal of an improvement of our assets do? It obviously would reduce deferred maintenance. Enhanced efficiencies of building systems and buildings. Carbon footprint is a big issue, and we're trying to reduce our carbon footprint. And the current old building systems are certainly less efficient than new ones. We have safety hazards in our buildings. Both building codes have changed. Certainly, seismic events that we talk about that are certainly, if you think about long term, are going to happen. The question is when. And so investing in the university assets are a community assets that are large that can certainly help a community resilience in the event of a 9-0 earthquake. The other thing that it certainly does is it improves access for students, staff, and the public. It reduces future costs in terms of operation and maintenance. Again, student outcomes are... We could bring academic professionals in here and talk about student outcomes that are certainly impeded by our current buildings and infrastructure. So thinking about the overall picture, you know, we are confident that the investment in deferred maintenance with the university matching funds is really one of the best investments you can make of state resources in terms of leverage and in terms of impact. Thank you.
I have three questions, Mr.
Please.
Chair. The first one is, what's the role of the foundations?
The role of the foundations is to, that's a great question, is to cultivate donor interest in projects that are aligned with university missions and goals and objectives.
I understand that.
Yes.
And so, served on a number of foundation boards.
Yes.
I'm talking about the expenditure side of the ledger. People donate to the foundation because they want to see the betterment of the university.
Mm-hmm.
How about spending decisions that advance this mission of deferred maintenance or better buildings?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I'm sorry.
How much money does the foundation spend on deferred maintenance or better buildings?
Oh. Well, they are providing, and I don't know the number off the top of my head. I'd have to go get that. But they are certainly providing support to our budget. They're providing capital, as you see on the matching list.
Maybe you'd get back to me. Have I been clear enough in the question, or maybe you call me and we take it offline because we're almost done here.
Yeah, sure.
Well, second question.
Senator, I'm sorry. Can I just briefly remark? It is hard a lot of times when people give gifts, they want to see their name somewhere. And when you
build a building.
Yeah, you can build a building, but you're probably not going to replace the roof and get any recognition.
Okay, but let's not parse my, I think I'm making my question pretty general.
Okay.
I want to know what role the foundations and the powerhouse fundraising capacity of the universities play in the overall recommendations in the report, which is take care of what you got and build some new stuff, and that's at
$150,000. May I add one thing though?
Sure.
That, and again, as a faculty member, I will say there is a frustration that the donor's desires are not necessarily what lines up with the university.
Okay, I'll buy that.
Is, I think, that's a persistent complaint among administrators and
developers. And some of it's tuition assistance versus edifice.
We
don't have to work it now, but I'm just telling you this is part of my thinking. Second question is, I know that the consultants, I'm surmising the consultants did not take into consideration previous recent legislative support.
Sure.
I'm thinking of, you know, some institutions getting multiple trips to the well, like a $38 million previous investment, and others perhaps if the line gets drawn, get shut out. We don't have to work it now, but that's a question. And last but not least is, how do the universities trade off your investment? And you've made a great case for capital. How do you trade off those requests for capital against your other requests? Because the universities have a plethora of other asks. For you guys, the statewide's come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
For U of O, there's been pressure for a thing called Shake Alert with a $10 million investment. How do you prioritize your desire for capital against some of these other investments? And would you forego the other investments in a constrained fiscal environment, which we have, despite this very optimistic report? We have got to be prudent. How do you trade off your desire for capital against some of those other investments?
Well, I think it's a complicated question. I think we work with the HEC to advance our request for operating capital, and that is something that they work with to prioritize through their lens what they put forth to the governor and then what the governor puts forth to the legislature. Certainly we have a long range, as a university specific now, we have a long range capital forecast and operating forecast that we look at our strategic plan and it informs all of those levers on how we're going to work with our foundation to prioritize their asks of the donors. We look at these what we could reasonably expect from the state in terms of capital. We look at operating forecasts of where we think the cap state's budget is going to do. So we're making those kinds of decisions. In fact, our board's going to look at our 10-year forecast here next week, looking at all of those things and looking and projecting that out and making those trade-offs within an institution. And I think we work with the HEC to make some of those trade-offs of the asks to the governor and the legislature.
I
don't mean to be argumentative, but this is going to be a tough decision for the legislature.
And I'd like to make one comment that it's really going to be a legislative responsibility, not for this group, when you raise the subject of certain kinds of asks like extension service or Shake Alert. Some of those requests, even though an activity is located on a university campus,
it has statewide benefits.
It's really more of a statewide service.
That's a good point.
And I think we haven't come to grips with how we should figure out
where those fit in a funding package, because it, in a way, the universities get dinged for it, because we say, oh, for accounting purposes, we've got to drop it in this paragraph here, but it's really serving this other purpose mm-hmm. over here.
Your point is very well taken.
If I could center just another recent example that might be of interest to you, on this list, after it was finalized, one institution realized that if they had used some dollars that they set aside for financial aid, they probably could have, they would have been three spots higher on this list, but they chose to reserve that, those dollars for financial aid programs. So at a campus level, those are the sorts of puts and takes that their leadership and their boards have to.
Well, and I presume those same puts and takes happened when a couple of the universities decided to subscribe to the state's opportunity to bring down their UAL.
Yes.
And huge investments were made, $60 million in one instance and I think 30 in another.
Haven't been made yet, but
you've taken up the capacity in the list, and maybe that checks haven't been written, but I presume you're going to follow through with those.
That's the plan.
Thank you.
Thank you
for making this presentation. I for one, am excited about the direction we're taking as a commission to be a little bit more specific as to themes that you think are important on deferred maintenance, and I think you've all contributed to our understanding of that and our ability to communicate that to the rest of the legislature. Really appreciate Representative Nathan and Senator Johnson for supporting us and carrying that message to the legislature as well. We're near at the end of our time, so I'll just look around the room quickly. You all are sort of quasi-members of the public. It feels like we should offer an opportunity for public comment if there are any things that need to be added. I don't see anyone to take care of that.
Anyone on the phone, Mr. Chair?
Good. Thank you for the reminder. Is there anyone on the phone who'd like to offer any public comment? I didn't hear any beeps for someone joining. So, oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah.
I missed it. But.
Is there anyone on the phone who'd like to offer public comment?
Okay. Thank you. So to reiterate what we heard from Ms. Lockwood-McCall, we will ask for your edits and comments in writing by noon on the 22nd. So just about
we'll send an email
from now. Yes, this will be summarized so that you hear it as well. That then will prompt us to come back, having aggregated those changes by Friday the 24th. And we'll schedule a conference call to review those edits and finalize things that final week of January. So any other comments or items for the agenda? Now it's time.
I also sent in that reminder email a copy of the housing recent thing for PAD, which
Thank
has
you.
A lot of information about their pipeline.
Thank
yes.
you.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Because you're interested in it. So.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay.
So our thanks again to the Flores and the rest of our team for getting everything on track. And thanks to everyone for your attendance and participation. We'll hang together again.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How about that?
Sure.
Nice work.
Thank you, guys.
Glad to
have
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.